We are 20 years, a little over 20 years into Paul's life as a believer. It's been a little bit over 20 years since the Lord encountered him on the road to Damascus and broke into his life and took everything that Paul had been up to that time and changed it. Didn't waste any of it. He just completely re-swizzled it, put it in a context, in a perspective of the things that we talked about last time, about the resurrection of Christ, about the exaltation of the Lord, the body of Christ, the unity of believers. All these things, he took basically what he had built into Paul's life through providence and now had basically rearranged it for service. And so Paul has seen 20-plus years of walking with the Lord. He's seen a lot of trials. He's walked in here to Jerusalem where he's been, the Lord has graciously forewarned him that there's going to be a tremendous amount of difficulties from his own people, rejection, persecution. And Paul knows this, and we are at the scene where at the end of this, he's been beaten by the mob in the temple. You remember he went into the temple. He's maintaining a low profile here in Jerusalem. So when he gets there, he goes first, meets with the church, and James and them talks about how sensitive issues are and that his reputation has preceded him, and for him to just sort of, you know, let, you know, show that he is a law observant Jew to the Jews. And so he was in the process of fulfilling the purification rites for some believe Christian Jews who had taken a Nazarite vows. And so he's all doing everything just quietly, decently, and in order. And then the Jews from Asia, some of the Jews from Asia that had apparently been following him and tracking him, as we've seen from his travels, they're there for Pentecost. They see him in the temple when he's paying the expenses for the last purification rites. And they start this mob uproar, right? So there's just this riot going on. The Roman soldiers looking down over out of the, you know, Fortress Antonia, see this riot going on. Their job is to disrupt riots and to try to keep things calm in the Jewish state. There's been a lot of problems in Palestine at that particular time in history. It's been growing. It will, in just a matter of 10 years, eventuate as the in less than 10 years, eventuate in the first Roman revolt, first Jewish war. So it's very problematic. Things are very, very sensitive. This riot goes on. The commander of 1,000, the Kiliarch, sees this going on. He rushes into the crowd to stop this, whatever's going on down there. He's dragging Paul into the barracks and to get him out of the, to try to calm the mob down, if nothing, not to protect Paul per se. Paul asks him, remember, could he speak there to the crowd in his defense? Because he used such a polite tone, and he realizes that he's probably going to need some more information about what's going on, because, you know, people are shouting and yelling, you know, one thing and another. He can't get any real legal data. He's actually a policeman, not a judge, so he's not going to be able to do any trials himself. He's going to have to refer the case. If he can't solve the case there locally, he's going to have to refer it to his boss, Felix, that's on the coast, which is later in this chapter. So he lets Paul speak, and Paul gives this very, very Jewish speech, and right up until the last phrase when Jesus tells him in a vision there in the temple that, go, I will send you to the Gentiles. That's when this uproar starts. And then he has to rescue Paul again. And so they're trying to figure out what's going on. The tribune orders him be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by scourging, finding out what they were shouting against him. And so that was the way you examined witnesses to try to get some truth, just normal folk. You just put them on basically on the rack and whipped them until they, you know, told told you everything. And so they had, we're at verse 25 where we see them, they're inside the barrack. We don't know what the mob is doing outside at this particular point. Hopefully theoretically they would have broken up by this time, or some of them are actually plotting against Paul at this particular point. Some of the groups are saying, this is not fair for the Romans to come and take our justice away. This guy, we should be killing this guy. He's an anti-Jew Jew. And so our story resumes actually inside the barracks, not what's going on in the temple.
As they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there,
"Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty?"
When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it.
"What are you going to do?"
he asked.
"This man is a Roman citizen."
The commander went to Paul.
Okay, now, under Roman law, it was absolutely forbidden to, as Paul pointed to that, it was illegal to do anything harsh, basically, to a Roman citizen that was uncondemned. I mean, you weren't allowed to actually put them in chains. You certainly weren't allowed to scourge them like he's about to be done. They were about to do to him. You couldn't keep them imprisoned except for protective custody, which is what's going to happen here. You could not, to flog them like this, Cicero had used a phrase that to flog an uncondemned Roman citizen was equivalent to murder. So this is a very huge issue that if Paul indeed is a Roman citizen, then what they have already done would jeopardize, would put this particular character, the commander there, at risk. He'll be already in trouble with his superiors for violating this man already for putting him in bonds. So when Paul evokes his right as a Roman citizen here, he just chose to do so. Sometimes he did, sometimes he didn't, but he did here early. So the centurion knows, the law. They all know the law, what they have to do. They have to protect Roman citizens from abusive treatment. So Licinius here, the commander here, is going to come in and talk to Paul about this to verify that this is the case.
And ask,
"Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?"
"Yes, I am."
"Yeah."
"Okay, now, it was a capital crime to claim to be a Roman citizen when you were not. There were basically two proofs. When you became a Roman citizen, you were written up in the genealogies, the mythical genealogies at Rome and the 31 tribes. They had a place where they kept these mythical tribal records, just like the genealogies in Judaism that would show, that Jesus was the descendant of David. When you became a citizen of Rome, you were put into one of those 31 tribes, basically. You had a sponsor, things of this type, and you were put in one of those tribes, and you would pick up one of those names. Those tribal names would be one of your five Roman names. There were five different Roman names. And so the proofs that you were a Roman citizen, you were given basically a wooden tablet that was very, very large. It would be the size roughly of a laptop or a notebook computer today. It's that big. Nobody carried these around. You normally kept these in a family vault type thing. You also were given a toga. There was an official toga that you could wear as a Roman citizen, which nobody wore because it was a very cumbersome vestment, garment. So nobody actually wore that. You could wear certain types of other garb that indicated your rank as a Roman citizen, senatorial class, equestrian status, various classes of citizenship. And then there were smaller versions of seals that you could carry around to prove it. But nobody actually did much of that because it was a capital crime to claim. So when the tribune asked him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" Paul says basically, yes. He just outright tells him that I am a Roman citizen, and then they have a dialogue.
Answered. Then the commander said,
I had to pay a big price for my citizenship, but I was born a citizen.
Paul replied.
Okay, now, you could not legally buy Roman citizenship. I mean, that was, you know, there was no such thing, right? But at this particular time, especially under Emperor Claudius, what you could do is bribe the provincial governors, like the Felices and the Festuses and the Gallios of the world, to support you put you as a candidate for enfranchisement. And so with a huge bribe, and bribes were, Dio Cassius talks about, the historian Dio Cassius talks about how Claudius's reign was just filled with people that were being, you know, were becoming Roman citizens by bribery, when that was obviously not, you know, you couldn't become a Roman citizen that way. But in Paul's case, he was above that because he was born a citizen. Now, being born a citizen means basically you were born to a Roman citizen, and you had a higher rank than people who became citizens. So at this little exchange here, Paul is now the social superior to the person he's talked to, the commander there. And that's established. And the Romans were very hierarchical, very, very hierarchical. So not only has this commander put Paul in bonds and was about to flog him, and has certainly treated him like he's not supposed to treat a Roman citizen, he's also has the additional crime of doing this to somebody that's his social superior. So when Paul was, of course, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, and this implies that his father was a Roman citizen. Now, his father could have been given Roman citizen. You could either be born a Roman citizen or be granted Roman citizenship by the emperor and the emperor's delegates. And so presumably what would happen is that if you were a non-Roman citizen out in the provinces, and if you rendered some exceptional service to the emperor or to the Roman Empire, then someone would grant you enfranchisement. You would become your name would be listed as in one of the 31 tribes from the sponsoring family. And so, but then that person that would have been given Roman citizenship would have been on the pier with the commander Lysias here. But then the children of somebody who had been given had been granted Roman citizenship, they were born citizens, and so they were of a higher class. They could there were certain offices that they could attain to, that they could run for. They could be senatorial class eventually, whereas people who were given Roman citizenship could not. There were, especially in Rome, ex-slaves. Roman slavery, the urban slavery at least, they didn't have a lot of agricultural slavery, the abusive stuff. By this time, there were Roman revolts, the slave revolts in 120 BC through about 80 BC. It sort of eliminated all the type of agricultural slavery that we had in the New World, in the U.S., the southern U.S., and in Brazil. That kind of slavery was not part of this. The urban slaves in Rome, they generally were, they were generally domestic in character. When they reached about 25 or 30, they were granted their freedom generally. And then they became basically business partners with their former owners. They could, of course, have servants themselves. And some of these that were, if you were a servant of like Caesar, you had immense power in those days. And they were called freedmen. And freedmen they generally could never be a Roman official, but their children, of course, would be born Roman citizens, and they could attain to the higher ranks. So Paul says, basically, I'm a citizen by birth. And so that sets up a social dynamic where the commander here now has to really backtracking now, has to show himself that he hasn't violated a couple of the major legal things that were set forth at the beginning of the Augustan age in the Lex Julia, the law of Julius Caesar, toward the treatment of Roman citizens.
Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. The next day,
Okay, so here it is at the day. It's still during the daytime. He's unbound Paul, but he's kept Paul basically in protective custody. He's not sure what to do. Like I say, he doesn't have legal authority to do a trial. He's going to have to figure out how to deal. A Roman citizen would not stand trial before the Jewish authorities for any reason whatsoever. And so he knows that he's going to have to end up sending him to Felix, who is basically the governor or the procurator over at Caesarea over on the coast. But he's going to have something to write up to send him. Right, so you're going to have some kind of charges. He's going to have to write up some documentation, police reports, you know, those kinds of the paperwork thing. And so the next day, he's going to ask the Roman leaders, since he tried getting an answer, remember, out of the crowd, the mob, right? But they were all shouting one thing or another. He couldn't get anything out of them. He figured that perhaps he'd go to the leadership, and they would be able to come up with something, you know, more calm, reasonable, a group, a leadership group, and that they would be able to tip him off as to what this was all about. So on the next day,
the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews. He released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them.
Okay, Paul was not bound in the sense of chains anymore. We saw him take the chains off. He was just kept. He was released. He was bound in the sense of protective custody. So, I mean, there's a mob rule out there. The guy's trying to stop the riot from continuing. It's turning out, you know, it's nighttime. Things are dying down. But he waits till the next morning. He calls for the Sanhedrin, the chief priest, and all the council, and the word council there is generally Sinhedrin, which is translated the Sanhedrin. It basically means those who sit together. There was this ruling council. We saw this, you know, you would see this in the Gospels. They were part of the trials of Jesus, even though there were only partial groups of that Sanhedrin there. The Sanhedrin was made up of the Pharisees, the priests, who were largely Sadducees, the Pharisees, the teachers, and their scribes, which would be sort of the archival class, the writing class, the scribe, of course. And then there would be the elders. That would be basically the landed aristocracy of Jerusalem. And so those three groups comprised the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was composed of 70 people, and the high priest counted as one, so it's 71 people. He called them together and they're not actually, in this particular case, they're not meeting. They're still in the temple precincts for this. They had their own meeting area southwest of the temple that we'll talk about later, but it looks like this was actually just there inside the temple courtyard where the riot had taken place. And he just basically calls them together. There were numerous meeting rooms around in the area. So he releases him from his, you know, his cell or his lodging or whatever. And then he ordered the chief priest and the council to meet. And technically speaking, he really didn't have a lot of authority to do that, except that he was so powerful a Roman figure as the police head and the army head that they all did it. If he said meet, then you met. So the chief priests, of course, are the Sadducean. They're the very rich people, very practical minded from a standpoint of almost Machiavellian they don't evidence a tremendous amount of religious sensibility compared to the Pharisees. So he brings Paul down and sets them before this group.
Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said,
"My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day."
Okay, so he looks around at the Sanhedrin. They're all around him, so his gaze is looking around there. You see the high priest there. The high priest is wearing, the chief priest is wearing a distinctive guard. This high priest here is Ananias. He's not the same Annas that was involved in, that was Caiaphas's father-in-law in Jesus. This is a sort of newcomer, very violent, cruel man in the Jewish records. Paul gets up there and basically says that he stands and basically calls God as his witness when he says, "I fulfill my duty in all good conscience." That's an appeal to God to strike him down if that's not the case. That's what that statement generally means. And so he makes a statement that basically, "I have done nothing against my people, against my upbringing as a Pharisee, any of this stuff, and that that I have done nothing in duplicity, that that I have not violated any of my Jewishness." That's what his statement basically means. And you see they're surrounding around him. And so he makes this statement, and then this happens.
This, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him,
"God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck."
Those who were standing near Paul said,
"You dare to insult God's high priest."
Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'"
Then Paul...
Okay, now, there's a little subtlety going on there. When the high priest, we don't really know whether he knew. I mean, the high priest is in there in distinctive garb. He should have known him. Now, Paul hasn't been there in Jerusalem since this guy has been in office. So, but like, the rogues would have tipped him off that this was the high priest, but he might not have seen, he might not have known that it was the high priest that ordered the striking. Like I say, these people are around. We don't know exactly how this played out, whether he was, like I say, he was, you know, looking around to the entire group and he was talking in this direction, and then the high priest, and he didn't know it was the high priest, out of the periphery ordered him struck. He gets struck. He responds to whoever, you know, that ordered that, because they're all there to judge. So it could be that he didn't know that it was the high priest that ordered the striking, or it could be this sarcasm that looked like in this video. Paul's comment when Ananias has him strike, but Ananias considers Paul's statement to be almost blasphemous and a violent untruth, because Paul is one of the main factors that's destroying Judaism's sort of internal fabric at a time that Judaism is already under a tremendous amount of pressure internally with terrorists inside, the Sicarii, the dagger people that would go into a village and burn it and plunder it because the Jews there in the little village would not cooperate with the extremist movement, the militaristic Jewish movement against Rome, or they would do that to a Gentile village. That particular, there were a number of factions that were at war there. Here's another one that's destroying it, according to their perspective, on a much wider scale. The Jews from Asia, they've heard reports of this guy. James, the brother of the Lord, had said this, that the whole city knew this, knew Paul. So they consider him a danger to sort of Jewish solidarity at a time where Jewish solidarity was important, both to keep peace with the Romans as well as to maintain status against the Romans, to keep their favored position that Judaism had always had within Greco-Roman law. And the Jews had a number of concessions that other governments, subservient governments under the Rome did not have. They were exempt from some of the taxes. They were allowed to, you know, to pursue their religion. They were allowed to do a number of things that other groups were not allowed to do. They had successfully negotiated these over the years, and these are in danger. These rights and privileges are in danger anytime there's riots, and they show that they're not quote unquote worthy of having this distinctive status. So this is just the high priest says, strike him on the mouth. And then Paul says, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. And he points out that that the action was against the law. You weren't supposed to judge, condemn somebody or strike them or punish them before they were condemned. You know, they were supposed to be the two and three witnesses. God had built that into his law that that you were supposed to get a fair trial. And the phrase here that God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. This phrase is from Ezekiel. And the wall, even though it's singular, it could be referring to the whole group there, because it's a reference to Ezekiel, the false prophets, the false religious leaders in Ezekiel. They're making all these promises about, you know, that God won't punish, you know, and that any day now that the subservient Judaists, the Jews are going to overthrow their captors, you know, the Babylonians. And these false prophets were likened by Ezekiel as these stones built into a wall. And instead of mortar being a solid, building it, they used just whitewash to sort of stick the little stones together. And so there was nothing really whole. There was no strength in the wall. And that when God's judgment would come, it would, because it wasn't held together with solid rock and it wasn't a solid edifice, that God's judgment would just sweep right through it. And so some of the commentators point out that this is a prophecy against Ananias, because 9 years after this event, he gets deposed earlier. So he gets deposed by the time we have within 2 years from this time, 2-3 years from now, he gets deposed from the high priest status. He's known to be a cruel, nobody liked this guy at all. When the Roman revolt, he's very, very pro-Roman. And when the Roman revolt breaks out, the Jewish loyalists find Ananias hiding in a culvert in outside of Jerusalem, and then they assassinate him there. And so God judges Ananias in accordance with this prophecy that his strengths and his power, nothing protects him from the judgment of God. And Ananias here, he was, like I say, he was known to be cruel. He would actually send out teams to the threshing floors where people were doing the harvest and stuff like that. And he would take by force the tithes that were due to be given to the regular priest for their sustenance. And so some of the older priests, according to the rabbinical literature, some of the elderly priests and the Josephus, some of the elderly priests starved to death because the high priest took all their, basically their food allowance that God had built into the tithing system. And so it was just exceptionally cruel. There's a lot of cruelty going on both sides of the Romans and the Jews at this time that creates the situation of the great Jewish revolt. So Paul says to this, and then somebody around says, would you revile God's priest? And the reviling is, nobody addresses the fact that he actually made a correct accusation against him, but they're pointing out about the whitewashed wall thing. And there's a passage in Exodus 22 that says, you shall not speak evil of God or of a ruler of his people. And that's what Paul points out to. But in that, some commentators believe that he really didn't know. You know, he hadn't been there very often in 25 years. The last time he was there was 5 years earlier, and he was only there for a couple of days at most. So he might not have known, he might not have known the character of this guy. But in this particular, most of the commentators think it was sarcasm. And we saw that in the face there of Paul, where he looks, I didn't know he was the high priest. In other words, by that kind of action, you wouldn't think that this guy, even though he was dressed as the high priest, was the high priest. So most of the folks think it was a sarcastic remark pointing out the failure of this law judge to reflect the ethics of the law, the principles of the law at all. So he makes this statement, and so they move on to the next set of comments.
Knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin,
"My brothers, I am a Pharisee."
Now notice he still has chains on in this scene. They may have put the chains back on just for this interrogation. This is actually not a trial, by the way. This is an interrogation. In other words, Lysanias, the commander, remember, wanted just to find out what the charges were, what they were accusing. This is not a trial. He's not delivering a Roman citizen over to a Jewish court whatsoever. That's totally against regulations, as it were. But this is an interrogation so that he's not present here. These are all clean people. He's an unclean Gentile. He's looking from the balcony. He's watching these proceedings. Most of it he's not going to be understanding. He's relying on a couple of people around the crowd to listen, see what's going on. He's dependent upon the elders and the chief priests to give him a report at the end of this interrogation as to what the charges are. So he's expecting a calm outcome of this. Paul is sitting there. He looks around the group. He knows he's not in the actual official Sanhedrin setting, which is in the what's called the Chamber of Hewn Stone, which is outside of the temple precincts. But Paul here, he looks around. He recognizes by the different garb that there are Pharisees here. Some of them he might have known as growing up there or on subsequent things. He recognizes that some of them are Sadducees and some of them are Pharisees. And he realizes that he has to sort of change the game here. He knows that everybody has been accusing him because the Jews in Asia, remember when he was going through all the Thessalonica and all those trials there, that, you know, when they wanted to trump up a charge against him, they would say he was against Caesar, right? He was preaching things that the Romans were against Romans and all this kind of stuff. So he knows that, you know, it's an intramural debate here it's a Jewish denomination versus another one. But he knows the way they're going to pitch it to Rome is that it is a government, that he's a dangerous criminal against the state, treason, terrorist type, right? And so he's going to try to redefine what the charges are into just a merely Jewish theological debate. And so he sees the Pharisees and the Sadducees here. And so this is the approach that he takes.
The son of a Pharisee, I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead.
Okay, now, what's really part that starts here is that Paul says, I am a Pharisee. He doesn't say that I was a Pharisee. He says, I am a Pharisee. I'm the son of Pharisees, which means that his father and his grandfather would have been in the Pharisaic party, which would have put it back prior to Jesus, in chronologically. So these would have been, remember, Jesus had a number of interactions with Pharisees in the Gospel of John. So the Pharisees were the most sort of scrupulous of the group. They believed in the law and the prophets. And their main theological opponents were the Sadducees, who would have been the sort of ultra-conservatives, oddly enough. The Sadducees only believed in the first five books of the Bible, only the books of Moses. They didn't believe in the oral law, the traditions of the elders, as Jesus called it. They did not believe in the prophets. The prophets were later; they were after Moses, so you couldn't prove anything to them from the prophets, and it sticks. So when Jesus is arguing with the Pharisee, he confines himself to the book of Moses, the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, in this discussion. And so one of the main differences between the Sadducees and the Pharisees is over the resurrection of the dead. And the Pharisees, of course, believed in a full resurrection. The Sadducees didn't. The Pharisees did. And since Paul has seen actually a resurrected person in the person of Jesus, this basically enforces his Pharisaic theology. He would differ from the other Pharisees, of course, in seeing the resurrection fulfilled in Jesus, or having a partial early first fruits fulfillment in Jesus. So he would differ from them there, of course, in the messianic interpretations of some of that. But still, Luke never ever disparages the Pharisees. In his gospel or in the book of Acts, the Pharisees are always portrayed in a good light. They have zeal according to knowledge. In the book of Mark, Jesus has an encounter with a Pharisee, and they discuss. And Jesus says one time when he saw that he answered circumspectly, I think is how the King James uses the phrase. He says, "You are not far from the kingdom of God," and that's the position. The Pharisees were part of the early church movement. Some of them were a little more legalistic than others about circumcision and the Mosaic law, as we've seen several times in the book of Acts. But he never represents us in any negative way. So Paul says, "I am a Pharisee," and he mentions this elsewhere in his epistles. So he gets up there and he says, "I am on trial," and that's him redefining what the trial is about. "I am on trial with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead." And the resurrection of the dead, of course, was a tenet there of Pharisaism. And the hope of that was the national Jewish hope, the hope that this resurrection would reinstate Israel to being the head of the nations, reinstate its kingdom, its messianic Davidic kingdom. That when the resurrection occurred, it was the resurrection of Israel that was promised, the nation, not just the resurrection of bodies, but the resurrection of the nation and the status and the power and glory of the Davidic and the Solomonic kingdoms. So he says that he just, and this may be just an abbreviation of what he says in Luke. Luke is, most of these speeches and things of this type, Luke has given a summary. There'll be parts in there that are clearly eyewitness testimony that don't agree with Luke's normal language and things of this type, where you use sources or official documents or things of this type. Paul may have expanded this a little bit here, but this statement itself was enough inflammatory and divisive. And the main point here is he's trying to show that the issue that's at hand is a theological one. It has nothing to do with Rome.
When he had said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all.
Okay, so we've seen this before. The Sadducees don't believe in angels or spirits, which is very odd because angels, of course, appear in the first five books of Moses at a number of times. You got the angel of the Lord, you got the angel in the burning bush, you got the angel at the sacrifice of Isaac. You got a number of angels. You got the angels ascending and descending on the ladder of Jacob. So you've got just angels throughout there. But and I don't know historically how they interpreted it. I have never seen anything on how they explain those passages away. There are some commentators that believe that this had to do with the intermediate state, that they didn't believe in angels and spirits in the intermediate state before the resurrection, but I can't find a lot of data on that. Luke states this here a number of times. This was also stated, of course, in the Gospels, that they did not hold to a resurrection of the dead, in the same sense, certainly, that the Pharisees did, or angels or spirits. And so they get into this huge debate, and this debate would have happened more often than just this time where Paul. It just so happened in this very inflammatory context where Paul just deliberately sides with one of the groups. He says, "I'm a Pharisee, and I'm on trial because I am a Pharisee." And so obviously the Pharisees come to the defense of their co-member who's used the magic phrase resurrection of the dead. And so we're having a mob outbreak here, almost just like we saw in that unruly group.
There was a great uproar. And some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously.
We find nothing wrong with this man.
They said.
What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?
You see, because there's a possibility, like I say, that some of them were at, high probability actually, that some of these people were at the mob uprising the day before. Because Paul had described that he had seen the resurrected Christ, right? And the Pharisees would count that as an angel or a spirit. So they could have, in their theology, people who had died before the bodily resurrection in the intermediate state, they were angels or spirits in their theology that could literally appear to humans on behalf of God. And so when Paul describes the visions of the resurrected Christ in that day before, if some of them were here, they would understand this resurrection of the dead. They would understand the vision of Jesus, not as a vision of God in any sense of the word, but as a vision of a spirit or an intermediate state saint, sanctified spirit that would be in the resurrection of the righteous someday. And so if that was the case, then they really couldn't fault him on that. They would disagree with him on the theology, but they would not have a major issue with Paul's being seen, you know, his claims could be tested, you know, somewhere else for their theological veracity, but there's nothing wrong with him. They pronounce him not guilty of any of the major charges about sedition and any of these kinds of things. And so they specifically say, we don't find anything wrong with this man. And so for the Romans, that would be good enough. If half the ruling council found him not guilty, and it turns out it's just a theological dispute, then case dismissed. This is no big deal. I'll let you guys work it out, right? And had it stopped there, Paul wouldn't have made it to Rome in captivity. He would have had to fund his own way. But what happens here is that this theological dispute, which had been brewing for decades, you know, actually generations, now it's just Paul is like the straw that breaks the camel's back here, in that because tensions are so high, divisiveness and factions within Judaism, and the Pharisees are stated in Jewish literature to hate this high priest. They hated Ananias. Like I say, it was their priest and some of their scribes that are abused by the cruelty of the high priest. So they say there's nothing wrong with him.
The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks.
See, this is just the mob rule all over again. Lysanias, the commander, hoped to get some answer out of these supposedly elite and erudite people. And all we've got there is just another outbreak and just another case of these riotous Jews, just at a different level over this guy. And so he doesn't learn anything. You know, there's nothing else he's going to be able to write down about this case. I mean, it does look like it's an intramural discussion, though, and purely Jewish. And that's what he's going to end up writing about when he sends him actually up to Felix. So he sends down the soldiers. He's looking over the edge. So he sends the soldiers down to take him away by force, because you can see there's an outbreak. He was afraid that he was going to be torn to pieces, just like they were trying to do to Paul the day before. So there, you know, he knows that this guy is obviously a troublemaker. It looks like, because everywhere he goes, there's a riot, you know, and the common folk in the temple, you know, wanted to tear him to pieces. Here was the ruling elite that was divided in whether they wanted to tear him to pieces, but he was still creating this huge disturbance, and it wouldn't matter whether the disturbance was a quote-unquote good disturbance or a bad one. It wouldn't make any difference to the commander's superior. A riot is a riot, and once a riot starts in one of the cities in the provinces of Rome, you know, people come running. We saw this before, you know, in Ephesus, you know, just people, hey, pick it up. They hear this tumult over, you know, 2 miles down the road. Everybody joins in. Nobody knows what's going on. This is one of the main problems for the Roman government was to try to keep this from breaking out into a crime against law and order and tearing down civic buildings and civic authority and things of this type. So they rescue Paul, bring him back into the barracks. He's back in now protective custody, and then we have a night vision.
The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said,
"Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome."
Okay, so this is the following night. So that's either that night, depending upon when it ended, or the night after. So there would have been a day of, there probably was a day where the Jews are conspiring. Some of the Jews are conspiring for this plot that we're about to mention that happens in the next verse. But Paul has a vision here, and Paul had seen a vision earlier, remember, had talked about how, you know, the Jews would persecute him and they wouldn't accept his words. And he told the Jews about that vision, you know, in his temple speech earlier, a couple of days earlier here. But the Lord appears to him and just tells him to take courage. And you can imagine that Paul is sort of a little discouraged right here now. Every court that he's appealed to, you know, the common folk, nobody's listening to him. He's been set up for this. The Lord has told him they will not accept your testimony, chains, and they will turn you over to the Gentiles. He knows where this is heading. He's been forewarned, as we've mentioned a couple of times. But he says, "You have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem. You just did this. You've done this a couple of times, but you've done it the last couple of days. You're going to do this in Rome too." So, in other words, he's telling him that no matter what is about to happen to Paul, Paul is going to end up in Rome. Now, Paul wanted to go to Rome, and he wanted to go to Rome on his way to Spain. Paul writes that he says, "My hope is to go to areas where the Lord has not been preached." He wanted to be a leading edge evangelist, to be out there in the at the frontiers, to be someone to give the light and hope to people who had not heard about the Lord at this particular at that point in history. But the Lord had just told him right here in an appearance that you are going to make it to Rome. No matter what happens, you're going to make it to Rome. He doesn't say how he's going to get there, but not only will he make it to Rome, but he will be able to testify in Rome. So he's just as he had done there in Jerusalem. And you wonder whether Paul thinks, well, am I going to be any more successful in Rome than I was here? His testimony so far in Jerusalem has been a bust. You know, he can sit there and he's still, you know, he's got wounds all over him. And you can't rest upon his confidence in the Pharisees to be, you know, huge recipients of his message. They were mostly, you know, digging in against the Sadducees. And so Paul thinks, you know, so what was all this about, Lord? You said, "I've testified to you. Was that of any good?" And we pointed out before that God is always working in those situations, that it's in the nooks and crannies of human experience in these groups that God has always got an audience, that there's somebody there that God is planting a seed, and it may not bloom for 30 years. It may not sprout for 30 years. But the testimony is what's the important thing, to get that out and to bear witness to what he had seen and heard, as Peter had done earlier. So he gives Paul the courage. He says, basically, just be strong. You're going to make it all the way to Rome.
The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot.
Okay, so this is the zealot kind of thing that Paul was himself. There's only 40 of these. Now, there are many more people like that involved in all this other stuff there in the temple group, and there's a whole lot more than 40 people are involved in the antagonism against Paul and things of this type. They took an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. And this was appropriate according to Jewish law. There was a, There was a segment of Judaism that was very militaristic, and allowed violence. It was just like Paul had done. You know, he was trying to throw them into prison to try them and kill them in the name of righteousness. When they would use proof texts from the Old Testament, they would pick the case of Phinehas, who drove the spear through the daughter of Cosby and the Israelite at Peor. They would draw proof texts from the Levites that went out and killed about a thousand or so. I think it may have been 4,000 people at the Golden Calf incident out of the, you know, roughly, I think it was 500,000 males. They killed 4,000 of them. There were a whole lot of folk involved in that, but these would have been just the ringleaders. There were a couple of incidences like that in the Old Testament that were people would use as that there was okay that zeal would do violence and kill people like this. The Mishnah describes a group of zealots that a priest, one of their priests, had performed some ritual in an unclean state. It was unclean. You're not supposed to do that. And they waited until the zealots waited until he left out. And the Mishnah says they clubbed his head to death, and that was counted as righteousness to these people. And so this zeal to kill something is in that same, you know, same stream that Paul was in. And it just, you know, the, you know, turnabout, now he sees the other side of this. And so they have a plot to do this. There were more than 40 that made this conspiracy. These wouldn't have been the leaders per se. Some of them might have been. They certainly would have been egged on by the leaders. But these would have been just some of those people influenced by the Jews of Asia. Maybe some of them are involved in this. But they make this plot. To eat or drink means that they're going to try to do this within a week, obviously, to make this happen. So they've got this plot.
They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you. On the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case, we are ready to kill him before he gets here."
Okay, so so these are not the chief priests and elders, but they go to the chief priest. They phone the plot. They go to the chief priests and elders. They assume that the chief priests and elders are going to agree with them that this is the righteous thing to do because they're going to lie about this. And they explain, we've strictly bound ourselves with an oath. We're going to kill Paul. Now, go along with us. You lie. So you, the chief priests and elders, along with the council that's going to include the Pharisees and other religious teachers, ask the commander to bring him down to you, pretending that you want to determine his case more exactly, that perhaps you're going to be calmer about it this time, and give less the commander the information he really needs. And when you have asked him to do that to you in your official capacity there, we're going to kill him before he gets down to you. And there's a quarter of a mile distance roughly from where the commander is, where Paul is in the barracks, just north of the temple, down to the Sanhedrin's official meeting place. The Chamber of Hewn Stone is what it was called. It was on the southwest wall, just south, just below the southwest wall of the temple precincts. And so there's a quarter mile distance that you've got to go outside of the temple precincts to move Paul. And what these zealots are going to do is they say, we're going to lie in ambush somewhere along that quarter of a mile path, and we're going to make sure that we kill him before he gets to you. And that way you won't have any complicity in this act. You won't be part of this. It was us that bear the responsibility because of our oath. They know that they're going to have to kill some Roman guards in this process. So this is not just, you know, an easy assassination. They're going to, you know, provoke the Roman lion here by killing some of the troops, Roman troops. There are 1,000 troops in the city. And so these 40 people, violent people, are planning to do this and without fear of reprisal. So they're going to do this. They're thinking perhaps they're going to be able to get away like a lot of the Roman revolutionaries at the time could sneak around and stuff like this, would get away with it. But there were hunt squads out that we'll see later when we get to Felix in a couple more verses here. There were death squads that would go out and find these revolutionaries and kill them. Romans that would go kill them. But they're willing to take this risk and assume Roman blood on this. Again, they're expecting the council to be evil enough to lie about this on pretense and convince the commander that he wants. And remember, the commander still needs information. Maybe he figures that these guys have got their act together after yesterday, after he had to force, you know, his soldiers in there. Said maybe it'll turn out better this time for this. So we've got this plot. Nobody knows this plot yet except all the Jewish leadership knows this. And they apparently lodged the request with the commander right about this time.
But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul...
Okay, now we don't know a whole lot about Paul's family. This is the only reference we have to his sister. So he's got a sister. This is son. This is his nephew. The word there is a diminutive version of young man. So he's 23, 24, no more than 26. He hears of this ambush because this, of course, this would have been discussed probably. It's a conspiracy, but there would have been, you know, are you in or out kind of discussions with a larger group than 40, right? So this would have been a group. What are we going to do about these? Some of these were said that's too extreme. I'm not part of this. They would have gone away. But somehow or another, his family that's there, whether they're visiting at Pentecost, whether they live there because he was raised at the feet of Gamaliel in the city, whether they've got, you know, we don't know how that works. But he hears, so he goes into the barracks and tells Paul. Now, remember, Paul is just in protective custody. So generally they don't feed you, by the way, in Roman custody. They do some Roman citizens, but generally, if you're dependent upon the nature of the crime, it wasn't their job to feed you like they do in jails. Right? So you were dependent upon visitors to get food and water, family members and things of this type. So Paul is in just protected custody. So this person comes in, his nephew comes in, is allowed to see Paul, goes into the barracks and tells Paul about this plot.
Called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him. So he took him to the commander. The centurion said,
Paul, the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you.
Okay, so Luke there in this story is using the heavy voice there for, you know, probably for the kids there because they had to flash on their faces smiling, you know. And Paul has enough freedom as his status as a Roman citizen, a born citizen, Roman citizen. He calls one of the centurions and says, you know, take this person to the commander, to the tribune. He's got something to tell him. And so they respect him enough. They know that he has, you know, protective rights and things of this type as a Roman citizen. So they take the young man, they take him to the tribune. And then Luke uses this phrase that Paul ends up loving. Paul the prisoner called me. And he's addressed as Paul the prisoner. And Paul, being a prisoner, is a very shameful thing in the ancient world. It is, you know, his honor and shame were just, it was a continuum, but one of the lowest kind of shames was being a prisoner, being under censure, being a criminal, even to the point of crucifixion was the lowest, of course, which our Lord did for us on our behalf, despising the shame, but he nonetheless took it on for us. And Paul calls himself twice in his epistles, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ, or for Jesus Christ, prisoner for the gospel. And so he's proud of that phrase because shame for the Lord is worthy of, is the highest status you can get in this reversal of values that God does in the world. That what the world considers a value is basically of no value to God. What God sees is the heart and cares for the real things. The world gives lip service to, but really values other things like achievement, ambition, pride, and, you know, status and things of this type. So Paul, a prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you. So the commander, like I say, you know, knows that he's on, you know, he has to be on careful ground with Paul, because Paul could report him as being bound, you know, and he would be in trouble. So he recognizes that Paul is probably not getting fair treatment from his people. And so he's open to this kind of thing.
The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said,
"The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow, on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him."
Okay, so to avoid being overheard by the centurion, or anybody else for that matter, he takes this young man aside for a private conference, and he says, "Okay, so what is it?" The young boy just basically repeats what he knows. The Jews have agreed, and there he talks about how there he puts in the conspirators and the Jewish authorities, and so he represents them. Of course, you know, the young man is a Jew. You know, he's Paul's kin, so he's Jewish, but he's talking about the Jewish leadership, and these rabble-rousers have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council, the Sanhedrin, tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire something about him. So he tells this, and he says, "But don't do it. Do not be persuaded by them, because more than 40 of the men are lying in ambush for him.
They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request."
Okay, so at this particular point, see, things have been moving ahead. Once they form the plot, they're out there probably in the foyer, in the lobby, with an official request to the commander for this, right? And so now that the commander's been briefed, says, "Do not do this," you know, the young man, that's part of sort of the impetuousness of his age, "don't do it." You know, instead of saying, "Let's," you know, "you should do what you think, you know, you are the authority here, make the wise choice," or something like that somebody perhaps older would have said, more politically, you know, correct or whatever. And they're right here waiting, so don't do it. They're going to press you for a decision, but don't do it because of this oath.
The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you've reported this to me." Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix."
Okay, so he hears this plot. The plot is against a Roman citizen. If the plot succeeds, he's in trouble because he let this happen to a Roman citizen. He let the Jews kill another Roman, and that's a problem in Palestine at this particular time. There's so much unrest. This is not goodness. And so he's got to defend a Roman citizen, and he's thinking that if he does protect Paul, obviously Paul's not going to press charges against him as well for the violation of his rights already. And so he calls two of his soldiers. He says, "Get ready 200 soldiers, 70 cavalry, and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at 9 o'clock tonight." So it's 9 p.m. roughly. He says, "Get them together. We're going to leave at 9 p.m. at night. Also provide horses for Paul to ride and bring him to Felix, the governor, in Caesarea." Now, there's a question in the text. We don't, the 200 spearmen, we don't really know what the word spearman means. It doesn't show up in other literature. And we don't know, I mean, it could either mean spearmen, like, it's a little redundant. The spearmen were the same as the infantry, the first 200. But looking at the form of the word, it could also mean, it's mean in other derivatives of it, meant in other contexts, mean those that gather horses, those that bring horses. So it could literally be that these are 200 people that are to bring horses to the 100 soldiers to ride, in addition to the professional horsemen, the cavalry. That would mean that we have a contingent of basically 270 people. If these 200 spearmen are 200 horse bringers, over against 470, which is if they're also some other different kind of soldier. They're going to go, basically, they've got to go 34 miles to Antipatris, then they got another 27 miles to go to Caesarea. They're going to do a forced march overnight. And infantry could do that. Infantry did go 34 miles on forced march at night, but generally not returning the next morning on foot, which is what this these 100, 200 soldiers, the foot soldiers, are going to do. So there's a good chance that what they've got are they were just provisioned with horses by the 200, quote-unquote, spearmen, and so that we have 270 that actually go, 200 of which return the next morning. The 70 horsemen, the cavalry, actually continue on with Paul. So in any case, that's a lot of the 1,000 men. So he's got 1,000 men, and either a half of them, 470, go, or a quarter of them, 270 of them, go on this journey for this one Roman citizen when Jerusalem's already up, swollen with anger and riots, and it's Pentecost. He needs those people back. So they're going to head out at night because of this plot thing. He's going to have to answer. He probably told them, yes, I will bring him down the next morning. He might have had to deceive the council as well, so the council didn't take matters in their own hand. If he knows that there's 40 people, then he might use a contingent, this Lord, 270, because he doesn't know whether the 40 are also going to attract some of those terrorists that are out in the rural areas. So he's got to make completely sure that this is handled correctly. So he does use a stronger force than he would have had it only been a conspiracy of four people, right? So he also gets multiple horses for Paul to ride to do a refresh when they get halfway through the journey. And so he says, you guys get ready. I got to write a letter to go with you to the boss there in Caesarea.
He wrote a letter as follows.
Claudius Lysias to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings.
Okay, by the way, Claudius is the name he would have taken when he bought his, when he bribed his citizenship, when he bribed the Roman for the Roman citizenship. He would have taken the name of Claudius as one of his family names, as one of his patron names. Lysias is his actual, one of his other Roman names, the one he was known by, and he would have been called Lysias. But in a formal letter like this, he would have used both nomens. He writes it with a standard greeting to the Excellency, Governor Felix. The governor was not actually required to be called Excellency, but it was just sort of an honorary title, and he just says greetings. And then we get this great spin letter from Lysias that's only matched by the same spin that the Jewish lawyer is going to do in just a few minutes.
This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he is a Roman citizen.
Okay, so, you know, you already know that this is really stretching the truth here. He, of course, did not know he was a Roman citizen until he was about to scourge him. He did rescue Paul, but it had nothing to do with, to protect Paul. It just had to do with trying to calm the riot down. He assumed Paul was guilty, and he was going to scourge him to find out why, right? So the man was seized. So he stretches the truth, about the why he rescued him.
I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment.
Okay, now Luke has pointed out this before. We've seen, every time that the Christians go up against the Roman government, anytime they decide something, they say they're not guilty, that there's nothing worthy of death or imprisonment, there's nothing seditious, There's no insurrection going on here. There's nothing like this happening here. These are just the sect of Judaism. They're not the Sicari dagger people. They're not these revolutionaries and anti-Roman folk, things of this type. They may be, seem to be a little deluded about this resurrection, you know, of this dead person. But they don't, they're not worthy of death or imprisonment. And so Lysias has pointed this out. He said, I tried to get an answer out of these guys. And when they started accusing him, it was just about their theology, their law. It had nothing to do with, the stuff that Roman courts deal with, a criminal law. But they found that he was not charged with anything with death or imprisonment.
When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him.
Okay, now, as I pointed out, Lysias is not able to actually try. He's not a judge, per se. He doesn't have any kind of scepter authority like that. He is a military presence. He commands a military force. He is not a ruler. When you had to get a ruling inside of Jerusalem, you had to go to Caesarea, or Caesarea had to come to you. So Lysias had no way of doing this. And so he basically said they were going to kill him. He's a Roman citizen. I protected him once. Now I'm protecting him again. I sent him to you, and I've ordered his accusers to state before you what they have had against him. So when he told them, he did all the movement by night, right? But that meant that basically by the time he would have told, or else he did this in the early morning, he told them that they have to go make the accusations to press charges at Caesarea. Now, one thing you have to know about Roman law is that the only people that could actually accuse you were the eyewitnesses, that it couldn't be secondhand. That testimony did not work. You had to have, your accuser had to be an eyewitness. And if the eyewitness that pressed the charges left or fled or didn't show up for the trial, you could prosecute the accuser. And they were looked upon very poorly for sort of troubling the state, so to speak, with frivolity. And so Lysias is correct in ordering his accusers to appear before Felix at Caesarea to state their case. But again, it has to be eyewitnesses. And we're going to see these in these next, chapter and a half, that there are no eyewitnesses to anything that's going on. The people that were there in the temple during that first riot, none of them are present for this, for his trials. So that's the letter that Lysias sends with the cavalry.
So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. The next day they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks.
Okay, let's look at that map now right quick, if we can, Bob. That plot, that JPEG. Just for a little piece of geography on this trip. As I mentioned, it was 34 miles from Jerusalem, northwest. There you see that little dotted line that goes from Jerusalem up. Jerusalem, it goes down off the mountains of Judea, goes down into the foothills. You see it goes through Lydda. Remember, we had a scene with Peter early in the book of Acts. There's a Christian community there. They go to Antipatris, that is 34 miles, according to that path from Jerusalem. It's another 27 miles up to Caesarea, but it's only 10 miles to the coast. So you see it's on the Yarkon River. It's about 10 miles. We're on the beautiful plain of Sharon. We talked about the Rose of Sharon and some of the hymnody. So they've got another, so the cavalry and the foot soldiers go, the foot soldiers, like I say, are probably on horses for this ride. They go to Antipatris. They probably make it there It'd be in 34 forced ride. That's about a 6 hour. You can make it in 5 or 6 hours. So they get there early morning. They're now outside of basically Jewish territory. They're now in a highly Gentile area. There's not all the Jewish terrorists and the military groups worked within the foothills and the mountains and the caves and used all the guerrilla warfare techniques there. When you get out here in the more Gentile area, the coastal plain there, they don't need all the protection of the infantry that's on horseback in this case. And so in the morning, they head back to restore the strength under Lysias there at Jerusalem during Pentecost, you know, for crowd control and just normal work. And then the 70 horsemen with Paul probably would have changed mounts there. That's why they were plural mounts. They would have then have gone the remaining 27 miles, arriving sometime in the afternoon there at Caesarea, the capital that the Romans rule from Caesarea. We've seen Caesarea a number of times. Cornelius, remember, was the first inbreaking of the Spirit. The what we call the Gentile Pentecost was there. We've seen Philip there at Caesarea with his four unmarried daughters who were prophetesses. You know, there's a thriving Christian community there. And all along this way that we know of, along this way. So the horsemen go back, the infantry go back on the horses. The cavalry goes on. They deliver the letter to the governor, and then they present Paul to the governor, Felix. And I lost my... Oh, that's because of that. Okay, we're done with the map now. Okay. There's Paul on horseback.
When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said,
I will hear your case when your accusers get here.
Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace.
Okay, now, see if we can get through this. When they get there, Felix is one of the few Roman officials who was a freedman. Remember I pointed out that generally you couldn't achieve high ranks as a freed slave, as a freedman, a Roman citizen that was a freed slave. He is one. Felix, was known in the literature, the Roman historical literature, as being a man of cruel and very lustful, barbarous. He was one for creating a lot of the unrest in Palestine between the Jews and Rome there at this particular point. He had the death squads that he sent out, and that was probably helpful, but the way he did it was so brutal and incited such violence against him. He is a very greedy man, was hated by the Jews. He eventually is deposed because of the way he handled a riot in Caesarea that was a Jewish, anti-Jewish clash. He will be deposed by that. But he is not thought of very well by either the Jews or the Romans. But he is in there. He reports to a boss. His boss is in Syria. He's over all of Syria, Palestine. And when he asks Paul where Paul is from, and Paul says he's basically from Cilicia, Cilicia is not in his jurisdiction. And technically what he could do is transfer him to Syria and wash his hands of this affair. But this would not make him any the Jews any happier with him, because now the Jews, to present their eyewitness case, would now have to travel all the way up to Syria, the capital of Syria, to prosecute this. So what Felix decides he's going to do is just leave him here and wait until his accusers arrive, and then he's going to work through this case. Felix, at this particular point, has been in power here about 5 years in this position. And before this, he has been over Samaria. So he had been over Samaria about 4 years. So he was pretty familiar with the Jewish culture, Jewish traditions, and even the Jewish sects, basically. So all the cults, when they're going to talk about, he's familiar with the way, the Christian way, he would be familiar with a lot of the Jewish sects and cults and movements and things of his type. So he says, basically, I will give you a hearing when the accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in basically Herod's praetorium. And that was sort of Herod's palace a little bit, but it didn't have all the rooms weren't scrumptious. There were places for custody and things of his type. And so he's just basically waiting until the accusers. And remember, the accusers are supposed to be eyewitness people. And I think since we're over here, we're going to wait for, we're going to start on this next section next time. And what we're going to see, though, is that Paul is going to, Paul is going to see the providence of God. When Jesus had told him the night before the plot that just as you've testified to me in Jerusalem, you're going to also testify to me in Rome. And the next day he finds out about this plot of 40 people that have taken this zealous oath, just like he had, to kill him, right? He's now got to fall back and trust the Lord that this is going to happen. And so he's sitting here watching the providence of God unfold in his life, having no idea how God is going to do this. I mean, the last thing he would have expected probably is for the governor, for the tribune, Lysias, to send 270 people to protect him to Caesarea. I mean, this is overkill. And even though, I mean, granted, he's got social rank over the commander, but still, that's extreme. And so he, as Paul will write, you know, in his life, you know, God works through government, that he can work through government and to pray for those in authority, you know, and that God would raise them to their best in their ministries and governing and conform them to his will for the people on the ground. And so he's sitting there seeing this happen right in front of his eyes as he's trying to think, okay, I'm going to end up in Rome somehow, but I'm going to have a trial here. And Felix, he's looking at Felix. He's going to be praying for Felix. He's going to be sharing his faith with Felix and his young wife Drusilla in this chapter, in the succeeding verses here. And so he's going to witness. He's testified in Rome. He's testified in Jerusalem. He's going to testify in Rome. But Paul is going to testify everywhere he can. He's going to have an opportunity here to witness, as Jesus had said, "You're going to be before. You're going to be brought before kings and rulers, and I will give you what to speak. I will give you the Spirit, will give you the words and the wisdom to speak the truth." And so Paul is seen, as we opened up this section, he was being beaten by his people. He was about to be beaten by the Roman centurion. He gets almost torn apart by the council. The next morning, there's a plot of 40 people to kill him. And he's escorted by armed guards to a particularly barbaric a ruler in the Roman establishment, Felix. And so he's still got that rock-solid promise that God said, "You're going to testify me in Rome." And as one commentator pointed out, that the providence of God protects us until the ministry is done. Paul never made it to Spain, as far as we know. There's some church traditions that said he did, but they're weak. They're not very, very strong from a historical standpoint. But his dream, he thought his ministry would finish when he had made it to Spain. And, you know, I know from personal experience, you know, you think, "Lord, I just want to get this couple more things done before you take me home." I think that's part of what my ministry is. I think I need to finish this set of articles or this outreach to these folk or things of this type. And you don't know. Paul may have felt that his calling was to get to Spain, but God says that no, it's Rome. And he didn't promise him he'd get to Spain. He promised him he'd get to Rome. But again, we don't know where the end is. And so we may think our work is unfinished by our standards, But if we walk with the Lord and we trust in this, and trust in His providence, and that He is indeed the one that we take our marching orders for every morning, and that we say, okay, so what is our marching orders today, Lord? I got one day. It looks like one day. So what do you want me to do this day? And so in the journal, you say, what did I do for the kingdom yesterday? What was it? So that any day when you're called, you can sit there and say, you know, up until this point, this is where I thought it was going. But Lord, take, you know, what did you do with the stuff that we did? What did you do with what you worked in my life so far? And that's our goal, of course, is to walk as Paul did in his experience and trust the Lord. Just keep going. And God delivers sometimes. Sometimes He doesn't. And you can't say that Paul, and when Paul writes about, reflects upon his life, he talks about, I know I have been chosen by God as an apostle because of all the hardships in my life. And so when he says, when he goes through, he said, to prove I'm an apostle, I've been stoned, I've been beaten, I've been, you know, adrift at sea, you know, I've been in danger from false brethren, from Jews, my own people, from Gentiles, from authorities. That was the proof that I've been walking with God. And so it's certainly not a Pollyanna existence on this side of death. But our hope is that in this, you know, our experiences here, that he does that life out of death thing, that he honors his son in our life and the way we respond to these things, be they anything from just, you know, outright persecution to just the little nagging difficulties in our life, you know, the splinters and the smashed fingers and the things of our lives that are difficult to work with. And we give thanks in all things because this is the will of God concerning us in Christ Jesus. And we lift it up and said, Lord, just use it. You know, I don't like it. It's not pleasant, but hey, it's your business. You're the one in charge here, and you use it to honor your son in some way, whether that's just your work in my life, conforming me to the image of Christ, or it spills over. And I was arguing with the Lord about something. I was whining about something this week, you know, and I was out driving around and saying, I don't know your will. I don't know your heart like I want to. I want to know it. And I realized, you know, in that conversation, as the Spirit was sort of working in me, I said, no, you don't have to know it. You just have to be it. You got to realize you don't have necessarily full cognitive understanding of how I'm conforming your heart to my heart, Glenn. It's just when you get in the situations where you don't know what the will of God is, I'm going to do it anyway. As I conform your heart, sometimes you're not going to understand that you're being conformed, that you don't see it as that. You see it as weakness. You see it as indecision. You see it as this. But I'm in there, you know, I say, trying to create my heart in you, whether you understand it or not and can sit there and predict what the action is. I'm still going to take those moments of impulse sometimes. And I'm going to let my heart that I'm building inside your heart, I'm going to let it out. And so I have to understand that sometimes it's not a matter of me knowing the will of God. It's just that the heart of God responds, and I do the will of God. Yeah, the Lord Jesus was a little different, you know, in that the Father showed him everything he was doing. And the goal in our Christian life is being conformed to the image of Christ, is that our responses are Christ-like. And it doesn't have to go through this cognitive filter that I'm always working for. You know, trying to know the will of God and know what the proper response. You're supposed to be doing all that. I'm not disputing that at all. It's just that I can't bank on that to live the life of faith. The life of faith is that trying to let the Spirit break through and respond. And I don't know, again, I'll second guess at all as to whether, you know, the motive was right. I'll rethink it and overanalyze it at the end of the day. But I just count that in, you know, God is working the will and the do of His good pleasure in my life. And so I'm counting on Him to override all of my trying to help Him out here in sanctification and for a little of this of His heart to eck out of my experience into the lives of those whose lives He wants to touch and share that with me. So, and we see this all the way through the book of Acts, God just constantly breaking out of these lives. It's just such beauty. And so we count on Him to produce this beauty in our lives, just as He's produced beauty in others' lives that have spoken into our hearts, into our lives, and that we are thankful for. So let's close in a word of prayer. We do thank You, Father, for just Your constant work in us. And we just you know, we just want to be patient and, you know, more with ourselves and with you. And just, we know that you're working as quote unquote, as fast as you can right this minute in our lives, that everything that can be done with resurrection power is being done in our life right this minute. And it's quiet, it's subtle, it's subterranean, but it is no less an expression of the power that was in Christ when you raised him from the dead. And Lord, we don't see this. We, you know, we get discouraged with our sanctification sometime and our walk with you, with our fruitlessness, apparentness, and our discouragement, Lord. But we just got to just relax and trust. Help us to do that and celebrate that what you're doing in our lives and the lives of those around us, and that you did into our life through their lives. So thank you again for this time to study your word, see your power, see your beauty, see your grace, see your presence in these lives and in our lives. And we do pray that you would bring us safely together again next week, and this week that we would walk with you. We thank you again for our host and our hostess, for those in our group that have needs for healing, for encouragement, for jobs, for income, for newness, for our relationships, for the things that are necessary in their lives for this week and this month and this year and this decade, Lord, and this life. And bless them with your presence and your encouragement in their lives as we go forward. So thank you so much for our mothers and their mothers, and just the beauty and the incredible image that you used about yourself as a mother hen, drawing us to yourself and protecting us like you have done all these times in our lives. We ask this that we might honor you more, Lord Jesus, and that we might dance, be better dance partners with you, Holy Spirit, and be better sons to you, Father. In Jesus' name, amen.